Succession number 27308, Reel 4.
Ronald Walsh, Reel 4.
Right, where do you want me to go now?
What happened next?
Well, we were all, the survivors of us, were all in barracks for about a few days. No, I think about 3 days, 4 days, we kitted us up, just give us a kit. And they give us a watch, whether you have one or not. They give us a wristwatch. It's part of the kit, whether you have one or not. They give you one and a new kit. And that was it. Just the basic essentials. All the stuff you'd lost on the ship was gone. You never got anything for that. It was gone. I had a lot of tiddly suits on board and everything, money in the locker. All that lot was gone. And then I went on 14 days survivor's leave, which was great in those days, wartime, and had me 14 days and came back in the barracks, start again, you know, and I'd been thinking things over while I was on leave, and I thought, well, I don't know, wasn't very impressed with the gunnery side of it, not at all. I wasn't impressed at all. I thought, I think I'd try something different. And I thought, I'd put in for ASDIC, submarine detecting.
Could I just ask you before we go on to that, how well did you know Jack Mantle?
Oh, I knew him well, as in the mess deck. Obviously, he was the leading seaman. He was the leading hand of the next mess to me. So we were with him all day. We lived and slept. Oh, yeah.
What was he like?
It was all right. I knew them all. I got on more with the ones that were in HACP with me. There was a leading seaman Forbes, and there was a leading seaman Gold. Well, Forbes and Pilcher. I knew them mostly, but partnership work, you know, just knew him every, not very intimately. He got around a lot with a lean seaman Forbes, but I knew him. Obviously, I didn't do much time in there because I was working in the boat all the time. But I knew him as a lean seaman as well as any of the others. Bear in mind that not a lot of us really knew each other because we commissioned the Belfast the 1st of May and we were sunk on the 4th of July and there was 292 odds and I was hardly in the ship because I was always in the boat.
Were you surprised when he won the Victoria Cross for the action?
I don't know about surprised. No, I don't know about surprised. I was surprised because to me it was just a wartime action. And bearing in mind, I'd only just come back in and this was new to me. This wasn't what I'd always done. It was a bit of wartime stuff. And I thought, oh, if that's wartime, it sounds pretty exciting. At any rate, as I say, life went on. I put in for this ASDIC course. It was submarine detecting, and I got it granted. And from then on, I did quite a bit of training. Osprey, where they instructed, and moved up to Dunoon in Scotland. That was the initial training place. And then you did your practical across Scotland at Campbelltown. And the base, you know, over the west coast, a lovely little place, Campbelltown, we could go to sea and do trials with ASDICs and all that. We had submarines up there that used to go out with us and go down all day long. We'd be pinging them and all that lot, you know. And I had a good 2 or 3 months there in Nimrod, as it was called in Campbelltown, qualified for submarine detecting.
Can you take me through that initial training, how you learned to be an ASDIC operator?
Yeah. Well, first of all, you had to find out what it was all about. And they give you a rough idea. I said, all right, yeah, okay. You want to be an ASDIC. But if you're an ASDIC operator, you qualify and you're an ASDIC operator, what you got to do is you'll be sat in a little cabinet up on the bridge, or you'll be in a bigger cabinet down in the bottom of the ship. Depends on the way the ship's designed. He says, if you're down below, you're on the bottom of the ship, just above the oscillator that's underneath that sends out the beam. Now, in there is also a compartment where you can bring the oscillator up inside its dome and you can work on it or change it inside the ship, and then you can lower it with a new oscillator or whatever. But you also operate you operate your ASDICs from down there. On the other times, you'll be up on the bridge with everyone else. So then they taught us that the machine, the oscillator, would be down below the ship. By training it, you could turn it around in directions, and you could transmit a beam. I won't say an electrical current, because obviously it went through. It was more or less an electrical beam that you could transmit through the water underneath the ship. And that beam would go away until it disappeared out of range. When it got out of range, it disappeared. But if it hit an obstacle, let's just say a submarine, then the beam was reflected back to the oscillator. So by that, you got a sort of a ping, bang. Instead of a ping and gone, you got the old ping, beep, ping, beep. And once you got that, you had a contact. You had something there. And then you had to find out what it could be. If it was a submarine, it could be within 10 degrees extent of target. If it was about 14, it could be a shoal of fish, it could be a whale. It could be anything, it could be rocks, it could be... But what you wanted was something about 10 degrees, it could be a submarine. So if you had a contact, and you had a contact, and you had an extent of target somewhere around about 10 degrees, then you wanted something more, you could listen for it. And if you could hear the engines, if they were electrical, they'd be, if they were, they wouldn't be reciprocating where you got them, they'd be electrical. And if they were electrical, that could also be a submarine. So you had three things there. Then the other thing was it moving or was it still? So you would chop across the target until chop across in 2 degree transmissions across the target until you lost the echo, and then you would chop back and up would come the echo, and that would be the right cut on. Then you would go on across until you lost it, then you would come back until you got the left cut on. You'd look at the compass and see the extent of target was 8, 9, 10 degrees, whatever. So then you had the extent of target, you had engine sound, you had the right ping. Well, I'd say Doppler. You also got a different tone in the ping that you got back. You got a high pitched tone, which we called Doppler, or you got a low pitched tone. If it was a low pitched tone, the target was moving away. In other words, the target was getting further away and you were getting a lower pitched tone. But if it was coming towards you, then it would be coming quicker and you'd get high-pitched tone. So you'd get Doppler high or Doppler low. In other words, target moving away, target moving in, or closing, target closing. So you could more or less write a picture. You've got extent of target, you've got Doppler effect, right and left, moving or still. If you got the same cut on and same, you got everything. It was there. You could more or less see it. Sometimes there might be doubt, you know. But if you got a lot of things, you could say a submarine. So that meant that when you're at sea, like I was after on the Bulldog, and on the Bulldog, our compartment, our Asdic compartment, was right below, on the bottom of the ship. And when we closed up on control, on, you know, convoy duties, we went out on those convoy duties across the Atlantic. I went down below to the bottom of the ship and into my cabinet, and all the compartments up were closed, the watertight doors, hatches rather. So I was down there until my 4 hours had finished. And then the other relief would come down, and I'd go up, and we'd close the doors behind us, so if we got anything while we were down there, hard luck. That was your hard luck. Anyway, what we'd do is you'd be down there, and you'd get this ping, and you'd hear it. You had your earphones on, you'd get the ping, and you'd report contact bearing. Then it all started on the bridge. Contact bearing. Right, 250 degrees contact bearing, you know, or 090, and then the captain would say, all right, investigate, you know, and then you would cut your target, you'd get the extended target, you'd get the Doppler effect, you'd get the tone, you'd get all that lot, and you would say, submarine. And if you weren't sure, you'd say, doubtful, or non-sub, if it was big boy. Anyway, the captain would then have all this information, and having got all that, he would say, if he thought it necessary, he would attack. And by that, you've given him everything, and you'd said submarine. It was then up to him to decide if he, because also, he could hear all this lot on the bridge, because he had a relay on the bridge. He was listening to all the everything that was going on up on the bridge as well as I was, so he could then decide if he would attack or not. And if he did, then he would point the ship at the target and go full belt over it. And when the transmissions got louder and louder, we got nearer and nearer. As you got over the target, that you'd get instantaneous echoes. You'd report instantaneous echoes. The captain would know that you were over the sub, and he would then give the order, or just before, whichever he thought. Either just before he got instantaneous echoes, or he would give the order, fire all the depth charges. And then you'd get a pattern of depth charges go, and they would go down and explode it. Certain depths that were set on the depth charge before it was fired, so they'd go off at certain depths, and that was it. And then that was an attack.
Would you lose contact after that instantaneous echo? Would you then lose contact as you pass over?
Oh yeah, yeah, because your beam wasn't going anywhere; it was going up behind the sub. But what we did then is when we got so far, we turned around and picked the echo up again. Once we'd picked it up, the captain would decide whether to go over and give it another whack or not.
Would it be difficult to pick up the echo occasionally?
Oh, yeah, it just depends on what the conditions were. But then again, an operator could lose a contact by, I suppose, bad operating, whatever. He could go off on the right-hand extend the tire on the road and go too far and lose it, and then he's got to go searching around to find it again.
You were saying with the training, though, Ron, when you first started, they explained to you what ASDIC was,
yeah,
and where you would be, and
yeah,
they explained how you operated it.
Yeah.
How did they start you off on that training, though? How did they get you accustomed to all those different effects?
What was it was simple. We had submarines at Campbelltown. And we would go out in the morning and stay out all day, and we'd operate with them. I mean, they'd go up and they'd come down, and they'd go down, and then we'd pick them up all day long. We knew the sub was out there, and we had to go out and find it, and you'd get different numbers of the class would close up all day long. Ping, 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 echo bearing, so and so and so and so, and all that lot. We did it all up there at Campbelltown.
And what would you be training in? What type of vessel would you be training in? Did you train in a destroyer or a...
No, as a matter of fact, they had certain. I'll tell you what we used a lot was the Shamara. The Shamara was a luxury yacht, and it was owned by a well-known. I can't remember it was Lord someone or whatever. The Shamara was his private yacht, and the Navy took it over, and they installed an Aztec set in there. And we used to operate from them. They didn't use our end vessels so much. Many of them may have had one or two there that they used now and again as instruction progressed, you know. But mainly they had several of these yachts that were converted to Aztecs for Aztec training.
How long were you training on the Aztec? Was it, you said about a year, so was that...
Well, yeah, but it was cut down a bit. You had to... They couldn't afford it in the wartime. We had to have them. We were having a lot of trouble in the Atlantic. There was all this... they wanted them, but they give you a good... They give you a good training, and if you were able, then if you were suitable, then you were sent. That was as simple as that. Pick it up when you get out there. You had plenty of opportunity in the Atlantic to pick it up. And you had all day, that's all you did as an Aztec, right? And all the upper deck stuff was done by the seamen. But as all we did is went on for 4 hours, come off for 4 hours, went back on, and all that lot.
So you wouldn't have had an action station on board, would you?
My action station would have been the Aztecs.
So when did you join the Bulldog, roughly?
Oh, it must have been 41, I suppose. Yeah, 41, something like that. 41, that was my first ship as Aztecs, went up to Scapa Flow, and she was running from Scapa Flow, and we used to go halfway across the Atlantic, and we never went right across, of course, you're bearing in mind that I was below all this time, I was down in the bottom of the ship, and if I wasn't there, I was off watch, and I was sleeping So, but I do know we went halfway across, and then we changed escorts and turned around. They brought a convoy across. We took one there. We changed around, and it was sort of backwards and forwards. And I believe it was the Americans that were escorting the other side, although they were American destroyers that brought them across. We changed around and brought them back to Scapa Flow. We went to Scapa, they went wherever.
And what was the Bulldog? What type of ship was she? Can you describe her to me?
Well, yes, it was a pretty standard. Well, a matter of fact, she was a well-known... she won a lot of honours. She was she'd done a lot of work. Let's put it that way. Well, the Bulldog itself was... It had quite a distinguished war career, and there was a small piece in the Navy News which described it thoroughly. I'll just quote that. Perhaps the most famous of the Bulldogs was the 6th, a 1,360-ton Swan Hunter ship built in 1930. She won honours in the Battle of the Atlantic and on the Arctic escort work, and was involved in the capture of an Enigma machine and codes from U-110, which gave the opportunity to crack the code and help to finish the war quicker than it normally would have done. Now, what we did actually is we used to leave Scapa Flow, which was a bit desolate, and there was nothing really to go ashore for, only a canteen. And so we used to run from Scapa Flow across to halfway across the Atlantic, and then change convoys from America and bring them back. And my job was, as a submarine detector, was in the Aztec cabinet. Now, this was situated right on the bottom of the ship, just above the oscillator, which sent out the electronic beams, or the beams that picked up the submarine or any other echo. So I was more or less on the bottom of the ship, over the top of the oscillator. And then I would do 4-hour watches down there all the time we were at sea. In other words, there were 2 or 3 of us, and I would always be down in there until I was relieved. And after 4 hours down there, night or day, it didn't matter which, I would come up and into the mess, sling my hammock and get into that, or remain on the mess deck, whatever. But that was my sole job, was listening for contacts.
Can you describe your ASDIC cabinet? What was in the cabinet?
Well, all it was really was it was just above the oscillator, which went down below the ship's keel and was able to be directed in a complete 360 degree, which was operated by a machine inside the cabinet, where you could turn. At first, we used to turn 2 degrees at a time, like turn 2 degrees, transmit, turn 2 degrees, transmit, and so on, in which case, every time we were slowly sweeping an area. And that was situated in the compartment above the oscillator. The housing for the oscillator came right up into the compartment, so that if we damaged the oscillator at all, it could be brought up inside the ship and we could change it from inside the ship. Other than that, there was a big desk sort of thing, and the operating control unit. And really, that was in 360 degrees. And when we were operating, the officer on the bridge, the officer of the watch normally, would give an extent of sweep. In other words, you didn't sweep all round there, because obviously, say your convoy, you were going ahead, your convoy was on the starboard or right-hand side of you, then you only needed to sweep from ahead, more or less, to just after 90 degrees. Is where anything anywhere else, it didn't matter. All we were interested in is that area, say, from 0 degrees to 090. That would safeguard the convoy. If there was anything in there, we had to find it. This, of course, the sweep could be anything. It could be across the stern if we were behind the convoy or whatever. And there were different convoys, several convoys, who would have their own sweeps. So the convoy should have been, you know, closely safeguarded. But of course, sometimes they got through and ships were blown up. In fact, many were blown up. Sometimes they laid in wait and just opened up, you know. But that was what the main idea. And I suppose it was rather monotonous, because the weather wasn't always. It was terrible sometimes, and you used to go out. All I used to do is go out and come up down below and come up.
Would the weather affect how you could detect submarines? Could you use the oscillator all the time in bad weather?
It didn't. The weather didn't affect the transmissions at all, because they were underwater, and we didn't. We could poke them down in really. All the time we were doing convoys, we didn't have any real trouble with that. Maybe the echo might have been not so clear, I don't know. But at any rate, it didn't seem to affect it. We were transmitting below the water and after anything that was in the water.
Was it tiring work?
Oh, no, it wasn't. The only thing was, obviously, once you went down there for 4 hours, the safety of the ship depended on you, because you had to sweep whatever area you were told to sweep, and if there was a submarine there, you had to pick it up. You had to pick up the echo. And if you missed it, well, that was it. That really, I won't say it is completely on the map, because if you got an echo, You had to investigate it and decide. And as soon as you got an echo, you reported it to the bridge. Up there, they immediately, because they had loudspeakers on the bridge, listening to exactly what I was doing, or rather what I was operating. Now, they would then decide whether it was worth bothering with or not. So really all I did was pass on, but I had to pick up that echo so that they got the opportunity to say whatever. So that was really my routine. I'll tell you this, the weather was tragic at some time. There was nothing else in the cabinet. We got the old rolling and jumping and that, but my job was when I went down, the other one, my relief, or I went down relieved, the one relieved went off, he went out and back up. Myself, I sat down, I put on the earphones, and then I sat back and started transmission. Now, another important thing had come up before, when I first was instructed in this, one transmitted manually 2 degrees at a time. When I went to ships at sea, it was all different. The transmissions were done automatically. So all I had to do is if the officer of watch said sweep from 0 to 090, then all I had to do is let statics operating and just watch as it went 2 degrees at a time and then bring it back to naught and so on to 90. So all I had to do was sit back and operate it. So that made it a lot easier. So I had nothing else then. I had the earphones on and it was transmitting automatically. Now, there was a danger with 4 hours of sort of dropping off. It was fatal if you did, because you weren't covering the area. But I had an interest in writing poetry. I used to, in my spare time, yeah, do something on ships at sea where there was no leave or anything. I found an interest after the foil bank. I wrote a poem or two about the foil bank. It went down well with my local newspapers, and perhaps I thought I was a poet, I don't know. Anyway, I found that when I was operating down below on the Bulldog, I used to have a pad and pencil beside me, and I could sit there for 4 hours and think, and perhaps a poem would come up in my mind. I could jot it down, and then all of a sudden, if I got a ping, of course, I got straight onto it. So I was on the ball there. Other than that, that was only on the Bulldog, though. On other ships, like the Acute, you had the Asdic cabinet was up on the right-hand side of the bridge. So you had the officer watch, the captain, and everyone else looking over your shoulder.
How did you feel in the Bulldog about obviously being battened down at the bottom of the ship?
Well, it was the same as anything in the wartime. Whatever happened, it would happen. And as regards convoys, I'll tell you this. I used to go down on watch, and I don't know about anyone else, but it was you went down about lots of steps right to the bottom. You went through the mess decks, you went through the upper bits, and all I did is, sometimes you were so tired when you came off that I just used to go up to the first lot, to the mess deck, and crash in the hammock nettings. The hammock nettings then were all full up with hammocks. And I just used to stay in there. I mean, I was below deck, so the hatches were down. If anything happened, well, I'd luck. It was if I was operating and we had it was just too bad, because they wouldn't have opened up. You would have been down there, and that was it. But I never thought of it. Sometimes I'd come up and just crash in the netting, and my relief would come down, give me a shake, and I'd go back on watch again.